Instead, he opened his small pink mouth very wide, inserted his fist, and began to gnaw on it in a thoughtful manner. A small blonde boy in homespun breeks leaned on Jamie's knee, staring up at me in wonder.
"Who's that, Nunky?"
he asked in a loud whisper.
"That's your great auntie Claire," Jamie said gravely. "You'll have heard about her, I expect."
"Oh, aye,"
the little boy said, nodding madly.
"Is she as old as Granny?"
"Even older,"
Jamie said, nodding back solemnly.
The lad gawked up at me for a moment, then turned back to Jamie, face screwed up in scorn.
"Get on with your Nunky. She doesn't look anything as old as Granny. Why, there's scarce a bit of silver in her hair."
"Thank you, child," I said, beaming at him.
"Are you sure that's our great-auntie Claire?"
the boy went on, looking doubtfully at me.
"Mam says great-auntie Claire was maybe a witch, but this lady doesn't look much like it. She hasn't got a single wart on her nose that I can see."
"Thanks," I said again, a little more dryly. "And what's your name?"
He turned suddenly shy at being thus directly addressed, and buried his head in Jamie's sleeve, refusing to speak.
"This is Angus Walter Edwin Murray Carmichael," Jamie answered for him, ruffling the silky blonde hair. "Maggie's eldest son, and most commonly known as Wally."
"We call him Snotrag,"
a small red-haired girl standing by my knee informed me,
"'cause his neighbour's always clotted with gook."
Angus Walter jerked his face out of his uncle's shirt and glared at his female relation, his features beet red with fury.
"It's not," he shouted. "Take it back."
Not waiting to see whether she would or not, he flung himself at her, fists clenched, but was jerked off his feet by his great-uncle's hand attached to his collar.
"You dinna hit girls," Jamie informed him firmly. "It's not manly."
"But she said I was snotty,"
Angus Walter wailed.
"I must hit her."
"And it's no very civil to pass remarks about someone's personal appearance, Mistress Abigail," Jamie said severely to the little girl. "You should apologise to your cousin."
"Well, but he is,"
Abigail persisted, but then caught Jamie's stern eyes and dropped her own, flushing scarlet.
"Sorry, Wally,"
she murmured. Wally seemed at first indisposed to consider this adequate compensation for the insult he had suffered, but was at last prevailed upon to cease trying to hit his cousin by his uncle promising him a story.
"Tell the one about the Kelpie and the horseman,"
my red-haired acquaintance exclaimed, pushing forward to be in on it.
"No, the one about the devil's chess game,"
chimed in one of the other children. Jamie seemed to be a sort of magnet for them. Two boys were plucking at his coverlet, while a tiny brown-haired girl had climbed up onto the sofa back by his head and begun intently plaiting strands of his hair.
"Pretty, Nunky,"
she murmured, taking no part in the hail of suggestions.
"It's Wally's story," Jamie said firmly, quelling the incipient riot with a gesture. "He can choose as he likes."
He drew a clean handkerchief out from under the pillow and held it to Wally's nose, which was, in fact, rather unsightly.
"Blow,"
he said in an undertone, and then louder,
"and then tell me which you'll have, Wally."
Wally snuffled obligingly, then said,
"St. Bride and the geese, please, Nunky."
Jamie's eyes sought me, resting on my face with a thoughtful expression.
"All right," he said, after a pause. "Well, then, you'll ken that the grey lag mate for life. If you kill a grown goose hunting, you must always wait, for the mate will come to mourn. Then you must try to kill the second, too, for otherwise it will grieve itself to death, calling through the skies for the lost one."
Little Benjamin shifted in his wrappings, squirming in my arms. Jamie smiled and shifted his attention back to Wally, hanging open-mouthed on his great-uncle's knee.
"So," he said, "it was a time, more hundreds of years past than you could ken or dream of, that Bride first set foot on the stone of the Highlands, along with Michael the Blessed."
Benjamin let out a small squawk at this point and began to rootle at the front of my dress. Young Jamie and his siblings seemed to have disappeared. and after a moment's patting and joggling had proved vain, I left the room in search of Benjamin's mother, leaving the story in progress behind me. I found the lady in question in the kitchen, embedded in a large company of girls and women, and after turning Benjamin over to her, spent some time in introductions, greeting, and the sort of ritual by which women appraise each other openly and otherwise. The women were all very friendly. Evidently everyone knew or had been told who I was, for while they introduced me from one to another, there was no apparent surprise at the return of Jamie's first wife, either from the dead or from France, depending on what they'd been told. Still, there were very odd undercurrents passing through the gathering. They scrupulously avoided asking me questions. In another place, this might be mere politeness, but not in the Highlands, where any stranger's life history was customarily extracted in the course of a casual visit. And while they treated me with great courtesy and kindness, there were small looks from the corner of the eye, the passing of glances exchanged behind my back, and casual remarks made quietly in Gaelic. But strangest of all was Jenny's absence. She was the half-fire of Lallybroch. I'd never been in the house when it wasn't suffused with her presence, all the inhabitants in orbit about her like planets about the sun. I could think of nothing less like her than that she should leave her kitchen with such a mob of company in the house. Her presence was as strong now as the perfume of the fresh pine boughs that lay in a large pile in the back pantry, their presence beginning to scent the house. But of Jenny herself, not a hair was to be seen. She had avoided me since the night of my return with young Ian. Natural enough, I supposed, under the circumstances. Neither had I sought an interview with her. Both of us knew there was a reckoning to be made, but neither of us would seek it then. It was warm and cosy in the kitchen, too warm. The intermingled scents of drying cloth, hot starch, wet diapers, sweating bodies, oat cake frying in lard, and bread baking were becoming a bit too heady. And when Catherine mentioned the need of a pitcher of cream for the scones, I seized the opportunity to escape, volunteering to fetch it down from the dairy shed.
This ends Disc 19. Voyager, Disc 20.
After the press of heated bodies in the kitchen, the cold, damp air outside was so refreshing that I stood still for a minute, shaking the kitchen smells out of my petticoats and hair before making my way to the dairy shed. This shed was some distance away from the main house, convenient to the milking shed, which in turn was built to adjoin the two small paddocks in which sheep and goats were kept. Cattle were kept in the Highlands, but normally for beef rather than milk, cow's milk being thought suitable only for invalids. To my surprise, as I came out of the dairy shed, I saw Fergus leaning on the paddock fence, staring moodily at the mass of milling woolly backs below. I hadn't expected to see him here, and wondered whether Jamie knew he had returned. Jenny's prized merino sheep, imported, hand-fed, and a great deal more spoiled than any of her grandchildren, spotted me as I passed, and rushed en masse for the side of their pen, blatting frenziedly in hope of tidbits. Fergus looked up, startled at the racket, then waved half-heartedly. He called something, but it was impossible to hear him over the uproar. There was a large bin of frost-blasted cabbage heads near the pen. I pulled out a large, limp green head and doled out leaves to a dozen or so pairs of eagerly grasping lips in hopes of shutting them up. The ram, a huge woolly creature named Huey, with testicles that hung nearly to the ground like wool-covered footballs, shouldered his massive way into the front rank with a loud and autocratic baa. Fergus, who had reached my side by this time, picked up a whole cabbage and hurled it at Huey with considerable force and fair accuracy. "Tis-toi," he said irritably. Huey shied and let out an astonished, high-pitched "bee" as the cabbage bounced off his padded back. Then, shaking himself back into some semblance of dignity, he trotted off, testes swinging with offended majesty. His flock, sheep-like, trailed after him, uttering a low chorus of discontented baas in his wake. Fergus glowered malevolently after them. "Useless, noisy, smelly beasts," he said. Rather ungratefully, I thought, given that the scarf and stockings he was wearing had almost certainly been woven from their wool. "Nice to see you again, Fergus," I said, ignoring his mood. "Does Jamie know you're back yet?" I wondered just how much Fergus knew of recent events if he had just arrived at Lallybroch. "No," he said, rather listlessly. "I suppose I should tell him I am here." In spite of this, he made no move toward the house, but continued staring into the churned mud of the paddock. Something was obviously eating at him. I hoped nothing had gone wrong with his errand. "Did you find Mr. Gage all right?" I asked. He looked blank for a moment, then a spark of animation came back into his lean face. "Oh, yes, Milor was right. I went with Gage to warn the other members of the society, and then we went together to the tavern where they were to meet. Sure enough, there was a nest of customs men there waiting, disguised. And may they be waiting as long as their fellow in the cask, ha ha." The gleam of savage amusement died out of his eyes then, and he sighed. "I cannot expect to be paid for the pamphlets, of course. And even though the press was saved, God knows how long it may be until Milor's business is re-established." He spoke with such mournfulness that I was surprised. "You don't help with the printing business, do you?" I asked. He raised one shoulder and let it fall. "Not to say help, milady, but Milor was kind enough to allow me to invest a part of my share of the profits from the brandy in the printing business. In time, I should have become a full partner."
"I see," I said sympathetically. "Do you need money? Perhaps I can..."
He shot me a glance of surprise, and then a smile that displayed his perfect square white teeth.
"Thank you, milady, but no. I myself need very little, and I have enough."
He patted the side pocket of his coat, which jingled reassuringly. He paused, frowning, and thrust both wrists deep into the pockets of his coat.
"No," he said slowly. "It is only... well, the printing business is most respectable, milady."
"I suppose so," I said, slightly puzzled.
He caught my tone and smiled rather grimly.
"The difficulty, milady, is that while a smuggler may be in possession of an income more than sufficient for the support of a wife, smuggling, as a sole profession, is not likely to appeal to the parents of a respectable young lady."
"Oh ho," I said, everything becoming clear. "You want to get married to a respectable young lady?"
He nodded, a little shyly.
"Yes, madame, but her mother does not favour me."
I couldn't say I blamed the young lady's mother, all things considered. While Fergus was possessed of dark good looks and a dashing manner that might well win a young girl's heart, he lacked a few of the things that might appeal somewhat more to conservative Scottish parents, such as property, income, a left hand, and a last name. Likewise, while smuggling, cattle-lifting, and other forms of practical communism had a long and illustrious history in the Highlands, the French did not. And no matter how long Fergus himself had lived at Lallybroch, he remained as French as Notre Dame. He would, like me, always be an outlander.
"If I were a partner in a profitable printing firm, you see, perhaps the good lady might be induced to consider my suit," he explained. "But as it is..."
He shook his head disconsolately. I patted his arm sympathetically.
"Don't worry about it," I said. "We'll think of something.
Does Jamie know about this girl? I'm sure he'd be willing to speak to her mother for you."
To my surprise, he looked quite alarmed.
"Oh, no, milady. Please say nothing to him. There's a great many things of more importance to think of just now."
On the whole, I thought this was probably true, but I was surprised at his vehemence. Still, I agreed to say nothing to Jamie. My feet were growing chilly from standing in the frozen mud, and I suggested that we go inside.
"Perhaps a little later, milady," he said. "For now, I believe I'm not suitable company, even for sheep."
With a heavy sigh, he turned and trudged off toward the dovecot, shoulders slumped. To my surprise, Jenny was in the parlour with Jamie. She had been outside. Her cheeks and the end of her long, straight nose were pink with the cold, and the scent of winter mist lingered in her clothes.
"I've sent young Ian to saddle Donas," she said.
She frowned at her brother.
"Can you stand to walk to the barn, Jamie? Or had he best bring the beast round for you?"
Jamie stared up at her, one eyebrow raised.
"I can walk wherever it's needful to go, but I'm no going anywhere just now."
"Did I not tell you he'd be coming?" Jenny said impatiently. "Amy's Kittrick stopped by here last night and said he'd just come from Kinwallis. Hobart's meaning to come today, he said." She glanced at the pretty enamelled clock on the mantel. "If he left after breakfast, he'll be here within the hour."
Jamie frowned at his sister, tilting his head back against the sofa. "I told you, Jenny, I'm no afraid of Hobart Mackenzie," he said shortly. "Damned if I'll run from him."
Jenny's brows rose as she looked coldly at her brother.
"Oh, aye," she said. "You weren't afraid of Lyra either, and look where that got you."
She jerked her head at the sling on his arm. Despite himself, Jamie's mouth curled up on one side.
"Aye, well, it's a point," he said. "On the other hand, Jenny, you ken guns are scarcer than hen's teeth in the Highlands. I dinna think Hobart's going to come and ask to borrow my own pistol to shoot me with."
"I shouldna think he'd bother. He'd just walk in and spit you through the gizzard like the silly gander ye are," she snapped. Jamie laughed and she glared at him. I seized the moment to interrupt. "Who," I inquired, "is Hobart Mackenzie, and why exactly does he want to spit you like a gander?" Jamie turned his head to me, the light of amusement still in his eyes.
"Hobart is Lyra's brother, Sassenach," he explained. "As for spitting me or otherwise..."
"Lyra sent for him from Kinwallis, where he lives," Jenny interrupted, "and told him about all this." A slight impatient gesture encompassed me, Jamie, and the awkward situation in general.
"The notion being that Hobart's meant to come round and expunge the slight upon his sister's honour by expunging me," Jamie explained.
He seemed to find the idea entertaining. I wasn't so sure about it, and neither was Jenny.
"You're not worried about this, Hobart?" I asked. "Of course not," he said, a little irritably.
He turned to his sister.
"For God's sake, Jenny, you ken Hobart Mackenzie. The man couldna stick a pig without cutting off his own foot."
She looked him up and down, evidently gauging his ability to defend himself against an incompetent pig-sticker, and reluctantly concluding that he might manage, even one-handed.
"Mm-hmm," she said.
"Well, and what if he comes for you and you kill him, aye?
What then?" "Then he'll be dead, I expect," Jamie said dryly.
"And you'll be hanged for murder," she shot back, "or on the run, wi' all the rest of Lyra's kin after you. Want to start a blood feud, do you?"
Jamie narrowed his eyes at his sister, emphasising the already marked resemblance between them.
"What I want," he said, with exaggerated patience, "is my breakfast. Do you mean to feed me, or do you mean to wait until I faint from hunger, and then hide me in the priest's hole till Hobart leaves?"
Annoyance struggled with humour on Jenny's fine-boned face as she glared at her brother. As usual, with both phrases, humour won out.
"It's a thought," she said, teeth flashing in a brief reluctant smile. "If I could drag your stubborn carcass that far, I'd club you myself."
She shook her head and sighed.
"All right, Jamie, you'll have it your way. But you'll try not to make a mess on my good turkey carpet, aye?"
He looked up at her, long mouth curling up on one side.
"That's a promise, Jenny," he said. "Nay bloodshed in the parlour."
She snorted.
"Clot," she said, but without rancour. "I'll send Janet wi' your parritch."
And she was gone, in a swirl of skirts and petticoats.
"Did she say donors?" I asked, looking after her in bemusement. "Surely it isn't the same horse you took from Leoch."
"Och, no."
Jamie tilted his head back, smiling up at me.
"This is Donis's grandson, or one of them. We give the name to the sorrel colts in his honour."
I leaned over the back of the sofa, gently feeling down the length of the injured arm from the shoulder. "Sore?" I asked, seeing him wince as I pressed a few inches above the wound. It was better. The day before, the area of soreness had started higher.
"Not bad," he said.
He removed the sling and tried gingerly extending the arm, grimacing.
"I dinna think I'll turn handsprings a while yet, though."
I laughed.
"No, I don't suppose so."
I hesitated. "Jamie, this Hobart, you really don't think..."
"I don't," he said firmly. "And if I did, I'd still want my breakfast first. I dinna mean to be killed on an empty stomach."
I laughed again, somewhat reassured. "I'll go and get it for you," I promised. As I stepped out into the hall, though, I caught sight of a flutter through one of the windows and stopped to look. It was Jenny, cloaked and hooded against the cold, headed up the slope to the barn. Seized by a sudden impulse, I snatched a cloak from the hall tree and darted out after her. I had things to say to Jenny Murray, and this might be the best chance of catching her alone. I caught up with her just outside the barn. She heard my step behind her and turned, startled. She glanced about quickly, but saw we were alone. Realising that there was no way of putting off a confrontation, she squared her shoulders under the woolen cloak and lifted her head, meeting my eyes straight on. "I thought I'd best tell young Ian to unsaddle the horse," she said. "Then I'm going to the root cellar to fetch up some onions for a tart. Will you come with me?"
"I will."
Pulling my cloak tight around me against the winter wind, I followed her into the barn. It was warm inside, at least by contrast with the chill outdoors, dark and filled with a pleasant scent of horses, hay and manure. I paused a moment to let my eyes adapt to the dimness, but Jenny walked directly down the central aisle, footsteps light on the stone floor. Young Ian was sprawled at length on a pile of fresh straw. He sat up, blinking at the sound. Jenny glanced from her son to the stall, where a soft-eyed sorrel was peacefully munching hay from its manger, unburdened by saddle or bridle. "Did I not tell you to ready Donus?" she asked the boy, her voice sharp. Young Ian scratched his head, looking a little sheepish, and stood up.
"Aye, ma'am, you did," he said, "but I didn't think it worth the time to saddle him, only to have to unsaddle him again."
Jenny stared up at him.
"Oh, aye," she said. "And what made you so certain he wouldn't be needed?"
Young Ian shrugged and smiled down at her.
"Ma'am, you ken as well as I do that Uncle Jamie wouldna run from anything, let alone Uncle Hobart, don't you?" he added gently.
Jenny looked up at her son and sighed. Then a reluctant smile lighted her face and she reached up, smoothing the thick, untidy hair away from his face.
"Aye, wee Ian, I do."
Her hand lingered along his ruddy cheek, then dropped away.
"Go along to the house, then, and have a second breakfast with your uncle," she said. "Your auntie and I are going to the root cellar. But you come and fetch me smartly if Mr. Hobart Mackenzie should come, eh?"
"Right away, ma'am," he promised,
and shot for the house, impelled by the thought of food. Jenny watched him go, moving with the clumsy grace of a young whooping crane, and shook her head, the smile still on her lips.
"Sweet laddie," she murmured.
Then, recalled to the present circumstances, she turned to me with decision.
"Come along, then," she said. "I expect you want to talk to me, eh?"
Neither of us said anything until we reached the quiet sanctuary of the root cellar. It was a small room dug under the house, pungent with the scent of the long braided strings of onions and garlic that hung from the rafters, the sweet, spicy scent of dried apples, and the moist, earthy smell of potatoes spread in lumpy brown blankets over the shelves that lined the cellar.
"Do you remember telling me to plant potatoes?" Jenny asked, passing a hand lightly over the clustered tubers. "That was a lucky thing. 'Twas the potato crop kept us alive more than one winter after Culloden."
I remembered all right. I had told her, as we stood together on a cold autumn night about to part, she to return to a newborn baby, I to hunt for Jamie, an outlaw in the Highlands under sentence of death. I had found him and saved him, and Lallybroch, evidently. And she had tried to give them both to Lyra.
"Why?" I said softly at last.
I spoke to the top of her head, bent over her task. Her hand went out with the regularity of clockwork, pulling an onion from the long hanging braid, breaking the tough, withered stems from the plat, and tossing it into the basket she carried.
"Why did you do it?" I said.
I broke off an onion from another braid, but instead of putting it in the basket, held it in my hands, rolling it back and forth like a baseball, hearing the papery skin rustle between my palms.
"Why did I do what?"
Her voice was perfectly controlled again. Only someone who knew her well could have heard the note of strain in it. I knew her well, or had, at one time.
"Why did I make the match between my brother and Lyra, do you mean?"
She glanced up quickly, smooth black brows raised in question, but then bent back to the braid of onions.
"You're right. He wouldn't have done it without I made him."
"So you did make him do it," I said. The wind rattled the door of the root cellar, sending a small sifting of dirt down upon the cut stone steps.
"He was lonely," she said softly. "So lonely. I couldn't have bear to see him so. He was wretched for so long, you ken. Mourning for you."
"I thought he was dead," I said quietly, answering the unspoken accusation.
"He might as well have been," she said sharply, then raised her head and sighed, pushing back a lock of dark hair. "Aye, maybe you truly didna ken he'd lived. There were a great many who didn't after Culloden, and it's sure he thought you were dead and gone then. But he was sair wounded, and not only his leg. And when he came home from England..."
She shook her head and reached for another onion.
"He was whole enough to look at, but not..."
She gave me a look, straight on with those slanted blue eyes, so disturbingly like her brother's.
"He's no the sort of man should sleep alone, I..."
"Granted," I said shortly, "but we did live, the both of us. Why did you send for Lyra when we came back with young Ian?" Jenny didn't answer at first, but only went on reaching for onions, breaking, reaching.
"I liked you," she said at last, so low I could barely hear her. "Loved you, maybe, when you lived here with Jamie before."
"I liked you too," I said, just as softly.
"Then why?"
Her hands stilled at last, and she looked up at me, fists balled at her sides.
"When Ian told me you'd come back," she said slowly, eyes fastened on the onions, "you could have knocked me flat down with a feather. At first I was excited, wanted to see you, wanting to know where you'd been," she added, arching her brows slightly in inquiry. I didn't answer, and she went on. "But then I was afraid," she said softly. Her eyes slid away, shadowed by their thick fringe of black lashes. "I saw you ken," she said, still looking off into some unseeable distance. "When he wed Lyra, and them standing by the altar. You were there with him, standing at his left hand betwixt him and Lyra. And I kent that meant you were taken back."
The hair prickled slightly on the nape of my neck. She shook her head slowly, and I saw she had gone pale with the memory. She sat down on a barrel, the cloak spreading out around her like a flower.
"I'm not one of those born with the sight, nor one who has it regular. I've never had it before,
and hope never to have it again. But I saw ye there as clear as I see ye now, and it scared me so that I had to leave the room right in the midst of the vows.
She swallowed, looking at me directly.
I dinna ken who you are, she said softly. Or what? We dinna ken your people or your place. I never asked you, did I? Jamie chose you, that was enough. But then you were gone, and after so long, I thought he might have forgot you enough to wed again and be happy.
He wasn't, though, I said, hoping for confirmation from Jenny. She gave it, shaking her head.
No, she said quietly. But Jamie's a faithful man, aye? No matter how it was between the two of them, him and Lyra, if he'd sworn to be her man, he wouldn't leave her altogether. It didn't matter that he spent most of his time in Edinburgh. I kent he'd always come back here. He'd be bound here to the Highlands. But then you came back.
Her hands lay still in her lap, a rare sight. They were still finely shaped, long-fingered and deft, but the knuckles were red and rough with years of work, and the veins stood out blue beneath the thin white skin.
"D'ye ken?" she said, looking into her lap. "I've never been further than 10 miles from Lallybroch in all my life."
"No," I said, slightly startled. She shook her head slowly, then looked up at me.
"You have, though," she said. "You've travelled a great deal, I expect."
Her gaze searched my face, looking for clues.
"I have."
She nodded, as though thinking to herself.
"You'll go again," she said, nearly whispering. "I kent you would go again. You're not bound here, not like Lyra, not like me. And he would go with you, and I should never see him again."
She closed her eyes briefly, then opened them, looking at me under her fine dark brows.
"That's why," she said. "I thought if you kent about Lyra, you'd go again at once. And you did," she added with a faint grimace. "And Jamie would stay. But you came back."
Her shoulders rose in a faint, helpless shrug.
"And I see it's no good. He's bound to you for good or ill. It's you that's his wife. And if you leave again, he will go with you."
I searched helplessly for words to reassure her. "But I won't. I won't go again. I only want to stay here with him. Always." I laid a hand on her arm and she stiffened slightly. After a moment, she laid her own hand over mine. It was chilled, and the tip of her long, straight nose was red with cold.
"Folk say different things of the sight, aye," she said after a moment. "Some say it's doomed. Whatever you see that way must come to pass. But others say, nay, it's no but a warning. Take heed and you can change things. What do you think yourself?"
She looked sideways at me, curiously.
I took a deep breath, the smell of onions stinging in the back of my nose. This was hitting home in no uncertain terms.
"I don't know," I said,
and my voice shook slightly. "I'd always thought that of course you could change things if you knew about them. But now, I don't know," I ended softly, thinking of Culloden.
Jenny watched me, her eyes so deep a blue as almost to be black in the dim light. I wondered again just how much Jamie had told her, and how much she knew without the telling.
"But you must try, even so," she said with certainty. "You couldn't just leave it, could you?"
I didn't know whether she meant this personally, but I shook my head. "No," I said, "you couldn't. You're right, you have to try." We smiled at each other, a little shyly.
"You'll take good care of him," Jenny said suddenly. "Even if you go. You will, aye?"
I squeezed her cold fingers, feeling the bones of her hand light and fragile seeming in my grasp.
"I will," I said. "Then that's all right," she said softly, and squeezed back.
We sat for a moment, holding each other's hands, until the door of the root cellar swung open, admitting a blast of rain and wind down the stairs.
"Mam!"
Young Ian's head poked in, eyes bright with excitement.
"Hubert Mackenzie's come. Da says to come quick."
Jenny sprang to her feet, barely remembering to snatch up the basket of onions.
"Has he come down, then?" she asked anxiously. "Has he brought a pistol or a sword?"
Ian shook his head, his dark hair lifting wildly in the wind.
"Oh, no, ma'am," he said. "It's worse. He's brought a lawyer."
Anything less resembling vengeance incarnate than Hobart Mackenzie could scarcely be imagined. A small, light-boned man of about 30, he had pale blue, pale-lashed eyes with a tendency to water, and indeterminate features that began with a receding hairline and dwindled down into a similarly receding chin that seemed to be trying to escape into the folds of his stock. He was smoothing his hair when we came in the front door, a neatly curled bob wig sitting on the table beside him. He blinked at us in alarm, then snatched up the wig and crammed it on his head, bowing in the same motion.
"Mrs. Jenny," he said.
His small rabbity eyes flicked in my direction, away, and then back again, as though he hoped I really wasn't there, but was very much afraid I was. Jenny glanced from him to me, sighed deeply, and took the bull by the horns.
"Mr. Mackenzie," she said, dropping him a formal curtsy, "might I present my good sister Claire? Claire, Mr. Hobart Mackenzie of Kinwallis."
His mouth dropped open, and he simply gawked at me. I started to extend a hand to him, but thought better of it. I would have liked to know what Emily Post had to recommend in a situation like this, but as Miss Post wasn't present, I was forced to improvise.
"How nice to meet you," I said, smiling as cordially as possible.
"Ah," he said. He bobbed his head tentatively at me. "Your servant, ma'am." Fortunately, at this point in the proceedings, the door to the parlour opened. I looked at the small, neat figure framed in the doorway and let out a cry of delighted recognition.
"Ned! Ned Gowan!"
It was indeed Ned Gowan, the elderly Edinburgh lawyer who had once saved me from burning as a witch. He was noticeably more elderly now, shrunken with age and so heavily wrinkled as to look like one of the dried apples I had seen in the root cellar. The bright black eyes were the same, though, and they fastened on me at once with an expression of joy.
"My dear," he exclaimed, hastening forward at a rapid hobble.
He seized my hand, beaming, and pressed it to his withered lips in fervent gallantry.
"I had heard that you... How did you come to be so delightful to see you, so happy to see you again, but..."
A cough from Hobart Mackenzie interrupted this rapturous exchange, and Mr. Gowan looked up startled, then nodded.
"Why, of course, business first, my dear,"
he said with a gallant bow to me,
"and then, if you will, I should be most charmed to hear the tale of your adventures."
"Ah, I'll do my best," I said, wondering just how much he would insist on hearing.
"Splendid, splendid."
He glanced about the hall, bright little eyes taking in Hobart and Jenny, who had hung up her cloak and was smoothing her hair.
"Mr. Freezer and Mr. Murray are already in the parlour. Mr. Mackenzie, if you and the ladies would consent to join us, perhaps we can settle your affairs expeditiously and proceed to more congenial matters. If you will allow me, my dear."
He crooked a bony arm to me, invitingly. Jamie was still on the sofa where I had left him, and in approximately the same condition, that is, alive. The children were gone, with the exception of one chubby youngster who was curled up on Jamie's lap, fast asleep. Jamie's hair now sported several small plaits on either side, with silk ribbons woven gaily through them, which gave him an incongruously festive air.
"You look like the Cowardly Lion of Oz," I told him in an undertone, sitting down on a hassock behind his sofa.
I didn't think it likely that Hobart Mackenzie intended any outright mischief, but if anything happened, I meant to be in close reach of Jamie. He looked startled and put a hand to his head.
I do? Shh, I said. I'll tell you later.
The other participants had now arranged themselves around the parlour, Jenny sitting down by Ian on the other love seat, and Hobart and Mr. Gowan taking two velvet chairs.
"We are assembled?" Mr. Gowan inquired, glancing around the room. "All interested parties are present. Excellent. Well, to begin with, I must declare my own interest. I am here in the capacity of solicitor to Mr. Hobart Mackenzie, representing the interests of Mrs. James Fraser."
He saw me start, and added with precision,
"That is, the second Mrs. James Fraser, nee Lyra Mackenzie. That is understood."
He glanced inquiringly at Jamie, who nodded.
"That is good."
Mr. Gowan picked up a glass from the table next to him and took a tiny sip.
"My clients, the Mackenzies, have accepted my proposal to seek a legal solution to the imbroglio which, I understand, has resulted from the sudden and unexpected, though, of course, altogether happy and fortuitous," he added with a bow to me, "return of the first Mrs. Fraser."
He shook his head reprovingly at Jamie.
"You, my dear young man, have contrived to entangle yourself in considerable legal difficulties, I am sorry to say."
Jamie raised one eyebrow and looked at his sister.
"Aye, well, I had help," he said dryly. "Just what difficulties are we speaking of?" "Well, to begin with," Ned Gowan said cheerily, his sparkling black eyes sinking into nets of wrinkles as he smiled at me, "the first Mrs. Fraser would be well within her rights to bring a civil suit against you for adultery and criminal fornication forby, penalties for which include—"
Jamie glanced back at me with a quick blue gleam.
"I think I'm no so worried by that possibility," he told the lawyer. "What else?"
Ned Gowan nodded obligingly and held up one withered hand, folding down the fingers as he ticked off his points.
"With respect to the second Mrs. Fraser, nee Lyra Mackenzie, you could, of course, be charged with bigamous misconduct, intent to defraud, actual fraud committed, whether we intend or no, which is a separate question, felonious misrepresentation—"
He happily folded down his fourth finger and drew breath for more. "And—" Jamie had been listening patiently to this catalogue. Now he interrupted, leaning forward.
"Ned," he said gently, "what the hell does the bloody woman want?"
The small lawyer blinked behind his spectacles, lowered his hand, and cast up his eyes to the beams overhead.
"Well, the lady's chief desire, as stated," he said circumspectly, "is to see ye castrated and disembowelled in the market square at Brochmorda, and your head mounted on a stake over her gate."
Jamie's shoulders vibrated briefly, and he winced as the movement jarred his arm.
"I see," he said, his mouth twitching.
A smile gathered up the wrinkles by Ned's ancient mouth.
"I was obliged to inform Mrs.—" "That is, the lady," he amended, with a glance at me and a slight cough, "that her remedies under the law were somewhat more limited than would accommodate her desires."
"Quite," Jamie said dryly. "But I assume the general idea is that she doesn't particularly want me back as a husband."
"No," Hobart put in unexpectedly. "Crow's bait, maybe, but not a husband."
Ned cast a cold glance at his client.
"You will not compromise your case by admitting things in advance of settlement, eh?"
he said reprovingly.
"Or what are you paying me for?"
He turned back to Jamie, professional dignity unimpaired.
"While Miss Mackenzie does not wish to resume a marital position with regard to you, an action which would be impossible in any case," he added fairly, "unless you should wish to divorce the present Mrs. Fraser and remarry—" "No, I do not want to do that," Jamie assured him hurriedly, with another glance at me. "Well, in such case," Ned went on, unruffled, "I should advise my clients that it is more desirable, where possible, to avoid the cost and the publicity
he added, cocking an invisible eyebrow in admonition to Hobart, who nodded hastily.
"Of a suit at law, with a public trial and its consequent exposure of facts. That being the case..."
"How much?" Jamie interrupted.
"Mr. Fraser!" Ned Gowan looked shocked. "I haven't mentioned anything in the nature of a pecuniary settlement as yet."
"Only because you're too busy enjoying yourself, you wicked old rascal," Jamie said. He was irritated. A red patch burned over each cheekbone. But amused, too.
"Get to it, aye?"
Ned Gowan inclined his head ceremoniously.
"Well, you must understand," he began, "that a successful suit brought under the charges as described might result in Miss Mackenzie and her brother mulcting ye in substantial damages. Very substantial indeed," he added, with a faint lawyerly gloating at the prospect. "After all, Miss Mackenzie has not only been subject to public humiliation and ridicule leading to acute distress of mind, but is also threatened with loss of her chief means of support."
"She hasn't threatened with any such a thing," Jamie interrupted heatedly. "I told her I should go on supporting her and the two lassies. What does she think I am?"
Ned exchanged a glance with Hobart, who shook his head.
"You didn't want to know what she thinks you are," Hobart assured Jamie. "I wouldn't have thought she kent such words myself. But you do mean to pay?"
Jamie nodded impatiently, rubbing his good hand through his hair.
"Aye, I will." "Only until she's married again, though."
Everyone's head turned in surprise toward Jenny, who nodded firmly to Ned Gowan.
"If Jamie's married to Claire, the marriage between him and Lyra wasn't valid, aye?"
The lawyer bowed.
"That is true, Mrs. Murray."
"Well then," Jenny said in a decided manner, "she's free to marry again at once, as she knew. And once she does, my brother shouldn't be providing for her household."
"Excellent point, Mrs. Murray."
Ned Gowan took up his quill and scratched industriously.
"Well, we make progress," he declared,
laying it down again and beaming at the company.
"Now, the next point to be covered."
An hour later, the decanter of whiskey was empty, the sheets of foolscap on the table were filled with Ned Gowan's chicken scratchings, and everyone lay limp and exhausted, except Ned himself, spry and bright-eyed as ever.
"Excellent, excellent,"
he declared again, gathering up the sheets and tapping them neatly into order.
"So, the main provisions of the settlement are as follows. Mr. Fraser agrees to pay to Miss Mackenzie the sum of £500 in compensation for distress, inconvenience, and the loss of his conjugal services."
Jamie snorted slightly at this, but Ned affected not to hear him, continuing his synopsis.
"And in addition, agrees to maintain her household at the rate of £100 per annum until such time as the aforesaid Miss Mackenzie may marry again, at which time such payment shall cease. Mr. Fraser agrees also to provide a bride portion for each of Miss Mackenzie's daughters of an additional £300. And as a final provision, agrees not to pursue a prosecution against Miss Mackenzie for assault with intent to commit murder. In return, Miss Mackenzie acquits Mr. Fraser of any and all other claims. This is in accordance with your understanding and consent, Mr. Fraser."
He quirked a brow at Jamie.
"Aye, it is," Jamie said.
He was pale from sitting up too long, and there was a fine dew of sweat at his hairline. But he sat straight and tall, the child still asleep in his lap, thumb firmly embedded in her mouth.
"Excellent," Ned said again.
He rose, beaming, and bowed to the company.
"As our friend Dr. John Arbuthnot says, law is a bottomless pit. But not more so at the moment than my stomach, as that delectable aroma indicative of a saddle of mutton in our vicinity, Mrs. Jenny."
At table, I sat to one side of Jamie, Hobart Mackenzie to the other, now looking pink and relaxed. Mary McNab brought in the joint, and by ancient custom set it down in front of Jamie. Her gaze lingered on him a moment too long. He picked up the long, wicked carving knife with his good hand and offered it politely to Hobart.
"Will you have a go at it, Hobart?" he said. "Oh, no," Hobart said, waving it away. "Better let your wife carve it. I'm no hand wi' a knife. Likely cut off my finger instead." "You know me, Jamie," he said comfortably.
Jamie gave his erstwhile brother-in-law a long look over the salt cellar.
"Once I would have thought so, Hobart," he said. "Pass me the whiskey, aye?"
"The thing to do is to get her married at once," Jenny declared. The children and grandchildren had all retired, and Ned and Hobart had departed for Kinwallis, leaving the four of us to take stock over brandy and cream cakes in the laird's study. Jamie turned to his sister.
"The matchmaking's more in your line, aye?"
he said, with a noticeable edge to his voice.
"I expect you can think of a suitable man or two for the job, if you put your mind to it."
"I expect I can," she said, matching his edge with one of her own. She was embroidering, the needles stabbed through the linen fabric flashing in the lamplight. It had begun to sleet heavily outside, but the study was cosy, with a small fire on the hearth and the pool of lamplight spilling warmth over the battered desk and its burden of books and ledgers.
"There's the one thing about it," she said, eyes on her work. "Where do you mean to get £1,200, Jamie?"
"I'd been wondering that myself. The insurance settlement on the print shop had fallen far short of that amount, and I doubted that Jamie's share of the smuggling proceeds amounted to anything near that magnitude. Certainly Lallybroch itself couldn't supply the money. Survival in the Highlands was a chancy business, and even several good years in a row would provide only the barest surplus."
"Well, there's only the one place, isn't there?"
Ian looked from his wife to his brother-in-law and back. After a short silence, Jamie nodded.
"I suppose so," he said reluctantly.
He glanced at the window where the rain was slashing across the glass in slanting streaks.
"A vicious time of year for it, though."
Ian shrugged and sat forward a bit in his chair.
"The spring tide will be in a week."
Jamie frowned, looking troubled.
"Aye, that's so, but..." "There's no one has a better right to it, Jamie," Ian said.
He reached out and squeezed his friend's good arm, smiling.
"It was meant for Prince Charles's followers, aye. And ye were one of those, whether you wanted to be or no."
Jamie gave him back a rueful half-smile.
"Aye, I suppose that's true," he sighed. "In any case, it's the only thing I can see to do."
He glanced back and forth between Ian and Jenny, evidently debating whether to add something else. His sister knew him even better than I did. She lifted her head from her work and looked at him sharply. "What is it, Jamie?" she said. He took a deep breath.
"I want to take young Ian," he said.
"No," she said instantly. The needle had stopped, stuck halfway through a brilliant red bud in the pattern, the colour of blood against the white smock.
"He's old enough, Jenny," Jamie said quietly.
"He's not," she objected. "He's but barely 15. Michael and Jamie were both 16 at least, and better grown."
"Aye, but wee Ian's a better swimmer than either of his brothers," Ian said judiciously.
His forehead was furrowed with thought.
"It will have to be one of the lads, after all," he pointed out to Jenny.
He jerked his head toward Jamie, cradling his arm in its sling.
"Jamie canna very well be swimming himself in his present condition. Or Claire, for that matter," he added, with a smile at me.
"Swim?" I said, utterly bewildered. "Swim where?"
Ian looked taken aback for a moment. Then he glanced at Jamie, brows lifted.
"Oh, you hadn't told her?"
Jamie shook his head.
"I had, but not all of it."
He turned to me.
"It's the treasure, Sassenach, the seal's gold."
Unable to take the treasure with him, he had concealed it in its place and returned towards Muir.
"I dunna ken what best to do about it," he explained.
Duncan Kerr gave the care of it to me, but I had no notion who it belonged to, or who put it there, or what I was to do with it. The White Witch was all Duncan said, and that meant nothing to me but you, Sassenach.
Reluctant to make use of the treasure himself, and yet feeling that someone should know about it lest he die in prison, he had sent a carefully coded letter to Jenny and Ian at Lallybroch, giving the location of the cache and the use for which it had, presumably, been meant. Times had been hard for Jacobites then, sometimes even more so for those who had escaped to France, leaving lands and fortunes behind, than for those who remained to face English persecution in the Highlands. At about the same time, Lallybroch had experienced two bad crops in a row, and letters had reached them from France, asking for any help possible to succour erstwhile companions there in danger of starvation.
"We had nothing to send. In fact, we were damn close to starving here," Ian explained. "I sent word to Jamie, and he said as he thought perhaps it wouldn't be wrong to use a small bit of the treasure to help feed Prince Charles' followers."
"It seemed likely it was put there by one of the Stuart supporters," Jamie chimed in.
He cocked a ruddy brow at me, and his mouth quirked up at one corner.
"I thought I wouldn't send it to Prince Charles, though."
"Good thinking," I said dryly. "Any money given to Charles Stuart would have been wasted, squandered within weeks, and anyone who had known Charles intimately, as Jamie had, would know that very well."
Ian had taken his eldest son, Jamie, and made his way across Scotland to the Seal's Cove near Coigach. Fearful of any word of the treasure getting out, they hadn't sought a fisherman's boat, but instead young Jamie had swum to the Seal's Rock as his uncle had several years before. He had found the treasure in its place, abstracted two gold coins and three of the smaller gemstones, and secreting these in a bag tied securely round his neck, had replaced the rest of the treasure and made his way back through the surf, arriving exhausted. They had made their way to Inverness then, and taken ship to France, where their cousin, Jared Fraser, a successful expatriate wine merchant, had helped them to change the coins and jewels discreetly into cash, and taken the responsibility of distributing it among the Jacobites in need. Three times since, Ian had made the laborious trip to the coast with one of his sons, each time to abstract a small part of the hidden fortune to supply a need. Twice the money had gone to friends in need in France. Once it had been needed to purchase fresh planting stock for Lallybroch and provide the food to see its tenants through a long winter when the potato crop failed. Only Jenny, Ian, and the two elder boys, Jamie and Michael, knew of the treasure. Ian's wooden leg prevented his swimming to the Seal's Island, so one of his sons must always make the trip with him. I gathered that it had been something of a rite of passage for both young Jamie and Michael entrusted with such a great secret. Now it might be young Ian's turn.
"No," Jenny said again, but I thought her heart wasn't in it.
Ian was already nodding thoughtfully. "Would you take him with you to France too, Jamie?"
Jamie nodded.
"Aye, that's the thing. I shall have to leave Lallybroch and stay away for a good bit for Lyra's sake. I canna be living here with you under her nose," he said apologetically to me. "At least not until she's suitably wed to someone else."
He switched his attention back to Ian.
"I haven't told you everything that's happened in Edinburgh, Ian, but all things considered, I think it likely best I stay away from there for a time too."
I sat quietly, trying to digest this news. I hadn't realised that Jamie meant to leave Lallybroch. Leave Scotland altogether, it sounded like.
"So what do you mean to do, Jamie?"
Jenny had given up any pretence of sewing, and sat with her hands in her lap. He rubbed his nose, looking tired. This was the first day he had been up.
I privately thought he should have been back in bed hours ago.
But he had insisted upon staying up to preside over dinner and visit with everyone.
"Well," he said slowly, "Jared's offered more than once to take me into his firm. Perhaps I shall stay in France, at least for a year. I was thinking young Ian could go with us and be schooled in Paris.
Jenny and Ian